Well, we are in Psalm 64 tonight. I have titled the message, Secret Plots, Sharp Tongues. This particular psalm has a lot to do in regards with the tongue, as it shows up quite a bit in the psalms, actually, the issue of the tongue. But we have the superscription to the chief musician, the Psalm of David. So this psalm is again designated for the chief musician, sometimes also translated as for the choir director. It is a Psalm of David. And this psalm, as so many others, involved a time of crisis in David's life where he cries out to the Lord. You know one thing about David? He knew where to go in time of crisis. He went to the Lord. And so often we have issues involving some struggle this way or that way, and we turn to the Psalms. There's something for everybody, for every occasion in the Psalms. I try to read a psalm a day, a proverb a day, you know, wisdom, a balm for the soul. That's what the Psalms are, a lot of things there. But the exact occasion for this psalm is unknown. We don't know what situation was exactly. Could have fit a lot of different situations in his life. However, again, the emphasis is on the tongue of the wicked and their murderous plotting against David. You note on the overhead the outline, verses 1 through 6, secret plotting of the wicked, verses 7 through 9, reciprocal response of the Lord, and then response of the righteous, verse 10. Let's pick it up, verse 1. Hear my voice, O God, in my meditation. Preserve my life from fear of the enemy. David begins by asking God to hear, which is his way of asking God to respond. And once again, he's in need of help, God's help. He needs divine intervention. And again, through the Psalms, we consistently find David in trouble, which drives him to the Lord. And you know, that's one good thing about trouble. It does have a tendency to drive you to the Lord. I don't know about you, but when I think about my spiritual life, some of the worst times have been some of the best times, in the sense that it really does drive you into the heart of God when you're going through something like that. This is another one of those situations. Well, the word meditation can also be translated as complaint. When he says, hear my voice, O God, in my meditation. So as a complaint, it would mean that he's crying out to God to deal with these enemies. If you take it in the sense of meditation, then David contemplates their end, which he does do, as seen at the conclusion of the psalm. So I think a case can be made for either nuance here, and this particular word can have either one of those nuances. David not only asked God to deliver him from the enemy, but also to preserve him from the fear of the enemy. David Gazik says the word fear is commonly translated dread and speaks of something greater than normal fear of battle. David knew how crippling this kind of dread could be and prayed to be kept from it. You know, sometimes the fear is the worst part of whatever you're going through, and fear indeed can be a paralyzing thing. Warren Wiersbe says, fear of the Lord mobilizes us, but fear of man paralyzes us. Yeah, there's a lot of truth in that. We find this proverb, Proverbs 29, 25, the fear of man brings a snare, but whoever trusts in the Lord shall be safe. God has not given us a spirit of fear, 2 Timothy 1, 7, but at the same time, it is proper to pray for God to preserve us from crippling fear. We are all human, after all. You say, well, I'm never afraid. Yeah, and you never lie either, right? We're all human. We need God's help every step of the way, and I think if we're bold, it's because we have learned to rely upon the Lord for what we need in the midst of the situation. It's kind of like what David prayed in Psalm 56:3, whenever I am afraid, I will trust in you. He doesn't say, I'll never be afraid. He says, when I am afraid, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to trust in the Lord. It's appropriate to ask God to help you not be afraid in those situations that on the surface are very scary. Now, we all face those kind of situations in life where we're tempted to be afraid. I'm sometimes not only afraid what might happen to me, but I think about my kids, my grandkids, and you know, all the craziness. fear can start taking over. We need to ask God to help us not be afraid. Of course, there was a specific situation David was dealing with here. Notice what he says, verse 2, "Hide me from the secret plots of the wicked, from the rebellion of the workers of iniquity." David has three prayers here: hear me, preserve me, and hide me. The secret plots of the wicked has been translated here as the conspiracy of the wicked. These enemies were secretly plotting how they might take David out. And David wants God to provide cover for him. These people are wicked and rebellious. As workers of iniquity, they work at sinful perversion. And notice one of the things he zeroes in particular is their tongue. Verse 3, "who sharpen their tongue like a sword." You know how if you back in the old days, if you were, you know, you'd sharpen your sword, get it ready. So it'd be really effective in what do you do with swords? You kill people. They are sharpening their tongue like a sword. Boy, they're just getting it where it's really lethal. "Bend their bows to shoot their arrows." Bitter words. Their secret plots involve slanderous words and lies against David. And all intent on taking him out, like an arrow might take out prey. They shoot bitter words, that is, cruel, harmful, destructive words. This was not a case of words merely hurting. This was an active conspiracy to kill him. These are words that intended to take him out. This wasn't just like a little unfriendly. They are trying to really take David out. Verse 4, "that they may shoot in secret at the blameless. Suddenly they shoot at him and do not fear." They're shooting off their mouth. But it's interesting. Notice they shoot in secret, that they may shoot in secret at the blameless. They do it anonymously. Anonymously. You know, some of the devil's best work is done anonymously, right? Behind the scenes, in a hidden way, instead of to his face, they wouldn't say these things to his face, but secretly behind the scenes, they're plotting these things. They're saying these things. They shoot in secret at the blameless. I read this story years ago. I always thought it was an interesting, I assume it's a true story, but it's in one of my books that I have at home. But it goes like this. A preacher had on his desk a special book labeled "Complaints of Members Against One Another." When one of his people called to tell him the faults of another, he would say, "Well, here's my complaint book. I'll write down what you say, and you can sign it. And then when I have to take up the matter officially, I shall know what I may expect you to testify to." The sight of the open book and the ready pen had its effect. "Oh, no, I couldn't sign anything like that." And no entry was ever made. The preacher said he kept the book for 40 years, opened it probably 1,000 times, and never wrote a line in it. It's a lot safer to do this stuff secretly, isn't it? I don't want to just be out front with it here. I'm just kind of behind the scenes doing my thing. It's kind of the devil's way. Cowards shoot in secret, right? And so do the wicked. They shoot in secret at the blameless who don't even have a chance to defend themselves. There's no grounds for what they're saying. Notice what David says. They shoot in secret at the blameless. It's pure slander. In secret, they shoot at the blameless. Charles Spurgeon, you know, he was a pastor, and pastors, you know, I don't want to make this all about pastors, but pastors do get shot at, as do all God's people. But Spurgeon has an interesting quote here in this context. Spurgeon said, "An open liar is an angel compared with this demon. Vipers and cobras are harmless and amiable creatures compared with such a reptile. The devil himself might blush at being the father of so base an offspring." Boy, that is some pointed language, I tell you, coming from the Prince of Preachers. I think he felt this very sting a few times. It is very unpleasant, of course. Suddenly they shoot off their mouth. Suddenly they shoot at him and do not fear. Suddenly is the idea of unexpectedly or without warning. You know, I used to have a friend who would say to me, this is in my BC days, but he would say, when you least expect it, expect it. You know, it's like we were always, this one would do that and the other one would do something back or whatever. That's the way these people are. They're really kind of like snipers who are coming at you when you're not expecting it. They're like hitmen who attack in an unexpected manner under cover of secrecy, that they may shoot in secret at the blameless. They plot in secret, they shoot their mouths in secret, and they attack suddenly. They are really verbal snipers trying to take out David when he is vulnerable and has no way to defend himself. These people don't play fair at all. And it's a very wicked thing. Verse 5, they encourage themselves in an evil matter. They talk of laying snares secretly. There's a lot of secrecy involved here. They say, who will see them? So there is some camaraderie amongst these wicked people. They spur each other on in their wicked endeavors. They discuss their plans for laying secret snares, and they say, who will see? You know, their actions really show they have no fear of God. They have no fear of consequences. They really think that they are going to get away with this and that no one is going to hold them accountable. They think that because this is done secretly, that no one sees. It's like that story about the criminal, you know, who looked north and looked south and looked west and looked east, and since he didn't see anyone, he went ahead and did the crime. Well, just one problem. He forgot to look up, right? And those who say, who will see, have forgotten about God. Verse 6, they devise iniquities. We have perfected a shrewd scheme. Oh, man, it's shrewd. It's smart. It's clever. They have perfected. They think they've perfected a shrewd scheme. I mean, they're just so proud of this little plan. Both the inward thought and the heart of man are deep, David's commentary. Iniquities refers to actions that are morally wrong, unjust, wicked. These are wicked plans. And they are very cocksure of themselves. Note the boast here. They have perfected a shrewd scheme. Boy, it is so slick. They think they have perfected a perfect secret plan. I say this kind of ashamedly, but I remember as an unbeliever thinking about, you know, just the perfect crime. Isn't it crazy? I mean, now I look back on it. You talk about darkness. That's pretty dark. Why are you doing this? I lay on my bed thinking about how you could commit the perfect crime and never get caught. Wow. Craziness. Well, and then David adds this commentary. Both the inward thought and that of the heart of man are deep. It's in the context of sinfulness that he makes this statement. What he means by this is that depravity is mysteriously deep. Their boasting of their evil scheming shows the dark depths of their thought and heart. And boy, it's deep, right? Inspired commentary here, inspired revelation. Jeremiah 17:9, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? I mean, it's deep. Ecclesiastes 9:3, this is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that one thing happens to all. Truly the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that they go to the dead. You know, the true depths of depravity is known only by God. I don't think we ever see the full sinfulness of our own hearts. James Montgomery Boyce says, the Hebrew literally speaks of men's heart as being deep, the idea being that they're almost bottomless in their supply of evil deeds and cunning. It's deep. I always think this is a great statement from David where he says in Psalm 19, "Who can understand his errors? Cleanse me from secret faults." I don't know about you, but I often pray that. It's kind of like, I don't really don't know of anything there, but man, when I think about all my thoughts and everything, sometimes I don't know what's sin and what's not. There's secret stuff. Cleanse me from everything. Sometimes we get a glimpse into real raw depravity, and I think we say with David, both the inward thought and the heart of man are deep. That is deep with depravity. Before the flood, the divine commentary on humanity was this, as we see in Genesis chapter 6, verse 5. "Then the Lord saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually." Commentary on the human race. Well, after the flood, things were a lot better, weren't they? No. The next reference there, Genesis 8:21, is after the flood. "The Lord smelled a smoothing aroma." This is from chapter 8 and verse 21. "The Lord smelled a soothing aroma. Then the Lord said in his heart, 'I will never again curse the ground for man's sake, although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Nor will I again destroy every living thing as I have done.'" Still, nothing has really changed in the nature of man. The flood did not change the depravity of mankind. The only cure for a depraved heart is Jesus, is regeneration, a new birth, being born again, born of God, born of the Spirit of God. Only faith in Jesus Christ is going to really change a person. Only God can change people from the inside out. And the point of this psalm is that a prominent way in which depravity is displayed, deep depravity, it's displayed through the mouth. "These people plot in secret. They sharpen their tongues like a sword. They shoot their words in secret and unexpectedly. They converse among themselves about how no one will see. They congratulate themselves on what a shrewd plan they have. And their mouth tells on their depravity, all the while thinking that they're going to get away with it. Who sees?" I mean, this is some depraved, deep depraved thinking. But God, verse 7, "But God shall shoot at them with an arrow, suddenly they shall be wounded." Here's the problem. Depravity doesn't factor God in. Romans 3:18, "There is no fear of God before their eyes." What a scary thing to come to a point where you have no fear of God. That's really what's represented here. The wicked don't factor God in, but David did. David did. He believes that God will intervene. God's going to deal with these wicked people that have no fear. They shoot their wicked words at David, but God, he says, will shoot at them. And you know something about God? He's a very good shot. He never misses. "Suddenly they shall be wounded." Suddenly they are hit, just that quick, everything changes. Just that quick they go from being those who do not fear, verse 4, saying who will see, to being wounded by God's arrow. Again, David Gazik says, "Suddenly they shall be wounded" reminds us that often the judgment of God comes upon the wicked unexpectedly, without any warning. They think everything is fine. Until they are wounded. John MacArthur says the arrows of God, as Old Testament history demonstrates, include natural judgments such as deadly disease, defeat, and calamity. And it seems to me that God has a large array of arrows. He is sovereign over all, and he can wound in a wide assortment of ways. Derek Kidner says, "The brevity of God's countermeasures after the elaborate scheming of the wicked tells its own decisive tale. The wicked spend all this time plotting and scheming only to suddenly have God bring them down. All God needs do is let his arrow fly." Verse 8, "So he will make them stumble over their own tongue." Isn't that interesting? They're going to stumble, and there's going to be a stumbling over their own tongue. and all who see them shall flee away. Here the emphasis is on God's providential workings. God is going to work in such a way that their own words will come back on them. And in this they will be exposed before all, causing people to flee from them. God has a way of providentially bringing back on the wicked their own wicked ways. They reap in kind as they have sown. Back in Psalm 7, we read, he made a pit and dug it out and has fallen into the ditch which he made. It came back on him. His trouble shall return upon his own head, and his violent dealing shall come down on his own crown. David's enemies shot arrows at him, but God suddenly shot his arrows at them. David's enemies sought to try and trip him up, but God causes them to stumble and fall over their own tongue. They might try and mess with David, but God makes all the difference. The God factor makes all the difference. And this was David's testimony. And when God intervenes in this way, it will serve as a lesson for all who see it. They will flee. Verse 9, all men shall fear and shall declare the work of God, for they shall wisely consider his doing. This is going to be a very public event as David sees it. When God intervenes, it's going to be clear. And there's going to be some reverence. Oh, God is at work here. This is a God thing. And they're going to learn through this to fear, to reverence God. They will openly declare that this has been the intervening work of God. And ponder these things. They shall wisely consider his doing. You know what this really serves as? Theology 101. This is a Theology 101 class. David was anticipating God's intervening work that turns the slanderous words of his enemies on their head. And he does it in such a public manner that people will get it. Oh, God is intervening on David's behalf. Now, he didn't say exactly how God is going to do this, but he believed it would happen. And it would happen in such a way that David would be vindicated and God would be glorified before all who are watching. Previously, the wicked asked, who will see them? Verse 5. The answer is, everyone will see them because God will use them to teach a lesson to all people. Verse 10. The righteous shall be glad in the Lord and trust in him, and all the upright in heart shall glory. The righteous are God's people. Now, those who are aligned with God's man, in this case, David. And by the way, the one who you stand with is pretty telling, certainly was in this case. And when God turns the tables on the wicked and causes them to be exposed in their sinful lies and plotting, then the righteous will be glad. They will rejoice in God's vindication. The tables will then be turned. And it will further to strengthen their trust in the Lord. Notice the righteous shall be glad in the Lord and trust in him. I think the righteous were already trusting in him, but this will strengthen their faith as they see God intervene. That's what David's anticipating. And then the upright in heart will glory in the Lord. That is, they will celebrate the victory that he has brought and given. This psalm highlights the tongue and how the wicked use their tongues to try and take down God's people. Now, that was true in David's day, but do you think it's true in our day? I'm pretty sure the devil's strategies have not changed. One of his great weapons is the tongues of his people, who are very wicked. And it's a very serious matter to wickedly use the tongue. And we would say, well, this is just the wicked. But you know what? God's people still have the flesh, too. And we can do some things that aren't just too good sometimes. I think about what A.B. Simpson said in this regard. Here's a quote from him. He says, I would rather play with forked lightning or take in my hand living wires with their fiery current than to speak a reckless word against any servant of Christ or idly repeat the slanderous darts which thousands of Christians are hurling on others. And then notice the last line, to the hurt of their own souls and bodies. Yeah, I think that comes back. It's, it boomerangs. It's reciprocal. They're shooting at God's people, but God's going to intervene. The tongue is very reflective of the heart. How one speaks in reference to God's people is telling. Jesus said this in Matthew chapter 12, "A good man out of the good treasure of his heart brings forth good things. An evil man out of the evil treasure brings forth evil things. But I say to you that every idle word men may speak, they will give account of it in the day of judgment. For by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned." I think what Jesus is saying is that words are telling. It's not that sometimes we don't mess up. We all do, for sure. But words are telling. Well, may our hearts be right, which is reflected in how we speak of others. As Jesus said just before this, what I quoted here, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. No matter what the wicked say, in the end, the righteous will celebrate because God always has the last word. He always does. You know, I read J. Vernon McGee almost every week, and often J. Vernon McGee will say, "I have learned through the years just when people are attacking me in a sinful way, just to give them over to God, just to give this over to," he said, "he is a whole lot better at dealing with that than me." That's a great lesson, a very simple lesson, but a very great lesson in life. I see David here looking to God to deal with these people. Indeed, at the end of the day, those who look to God for vindication, look to God to right things and turn the tables and set things straight, indeed, at the end of the day, all the upright in heart shall glory. That is, we're going to forever celebrate what God has done on the behalf of his people. He is a faithful shepherd, and we can trust him whatever we're going through. No matter how wicked the enemies might be, indeed, God is on the side of his people. They may shoot at us, but God's got them in his sights as well. And of course, we pray that they repent as well. Okay, let's stand and have our closing song, and then I'll close in a word of prayer.